submitted for sounds from the Saturna Island wetlands, as well as some of our own recordings, field recordings. So you can find Democracy Now! At democracynow.org if you want to make sure to catch that. Otherwise, you can come here and listen to the beautiful sounds of nature for a full day. And our regularly scheduled programming will resume at midnight on Wednesday night, 0 o'clock Thursday morning. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. San Francisco, this is Democracy Now!
Deaths in ICE custody continue to skyrocket past previous records as the agency has been massively expanding the immigration detention system. A total of 48 people have died in ICE custody so far during the current Trump administration.
As ICE rapidly expands its immigration jail system, deaths in ICE custody are surging. At least 17 people have died this year, on average a person every week. 48 have died since President Trump returned to office. We'll talk to Detention Watch Network, then caught in the crackdown. As arrests at anti-ICE protests piled up, prosecutions crumbled. A ProPublica frontline investigation.
An investigation into the Trump administration's months-long crackdown.
Are you encountering a lot of resistance?
The most I've ever seen.
The pushback.
They are creating the emergency and the crisis that we then need to deal with.
I'm asking, who's detaining me?
And the fallout.
President Trump and I, along with others in the administration, have recognized that certain improvements could and should be made.
We'll speak to investigative reporter A.C. Thompson, and finally to the front lines of the animal rights movement. On Saturday, hundreds of activists attempted to rescue 2,000 beagles from Ridgeland Farms, a breeding facility in Wisconsin accused of animal cruelty.
The violence that we experienced today was off the charts. And yet, it does not compare to what the dogs go through.
Dozens of people were arrested. We'll go to Madison, Wisconsin to speak with one of the organizers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in San Francisco. There's uncertainty over whether the U.S. and Iran will hold another round of talks in Pakistan after the White House said Vice President J.D. Vance is preparing to depart for Islamabad today, even as Iran refused to confirm it'll participate. A spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry accused the U.S. of violating the 10-day ceasefire. He cited the U.S. Navy's seizure of an Iranian cargo ship Sunday while calling for the release of its sailors and vowing to retaliate. Meanwhile, President Trump's warned he's highly unlikely to extend the 10-day ceasefire with Iran beyond its expiration on Wednesday evening and said the U.S. will likely resume bombing immediately if Iran refuses a deal. On Capitol Hill, dozens of military veterans and their family members were arrested Monday as they nonviolently occupied the Cannon House office building to protest the U.S. and Israeli war on Iran while demanding a meeting with House Speaker Mike Johnson. At least 62 people were arrested, including elderly and disabled activists. Those protests continued. The protests were organized by a coalition that included About Face, Veterans for Peace, Common Defense, and Military Families Speak Out. This is Christina Sarson, a U.S. Army veteran from Pennsylvania.
I personally am here for my sons. As a veteran, I know the harm that wars do to civilian populations, but also to our soldiers. I'm talking about the loss of life. I'm talking about injuries and lives changed forever. I'm talking about PTSD and moral injury, and that's why I'm here today.
The State Department says it'll host a second round of talks between Lebanon and Israel in Washington, D.C. on Thursday. The first negotiation since a tenuous ceasefire went into effect last week. The announcement came as people across Lebanon held funerals Monday for loved ones whose bodies were retrieved from the rubble of buildings left flattened by Israeli strikes. Entire relatives prayed by the temporary graves of 80-year-old Hussein Dabouk and his 32-year-old son, Robbie, who were killed in the hours before the ceasefire took effect last Friday morning.
This family, why is it their fault? Is it because they didn't leave Tyre? Is this our fault that we stayed? We don't want to leave our land. Our land is our honor and our dignity. What did these people do wrong for Israel to come and bomb them? You, Israel, who were supposed to do a ceasefire, committed a crime before it could take effect.
Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli attacks in March and April killed over 2,300 people, leaving over 6,700 injured and 1.2 million people displaced from their homes. In Gaza, Israeli strikes have killed at least five Palestinians in separate incidents. An Israeli airstrike killed at least three people in western Khan Yunis, according to health officials at Nasser Hospital. Israeli attacks have killed more than 750 Palestinians since last year's so-called ceasefire deal took effect. It comes as Israel's officially reestablished the Sinur settlement in the occupied West Bank, more than 20 years after it was dismantled. Elsewhere, a Palestinian boy was killed earlier today after being struck by a vehicle in the security convoy of an Israeli minister in the occupied West Bank. 16-year-old Mohammed Majdi Al-Jabir was riding his bicycle to school when he was run over. Haaretz reports the convoy was en route to secure Israeli settlement minister Orit Strok, who lives in an illegal Israeli settlement in Hebron. Meanwhile, a joint report by the EU, UN, and the World Bank reveals $71.4 billion will be needed over the next decade for Gaza's recovery and reconstruction. The report also warns human development across the Gaza Strip has been set back by 77 years. Amnesty International has released its annual Global Human Rights Report describing the leaders of Israel, Russia, and the United States as, quote, voracious predators, unquote, intent on economic and political domination. The report documents the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, which has killed more than 3,000 people, Israeli attacks in Lebanon, which have killed nearly 2,400, and the death toll in Gaza, which has surpassed 72,500 since October 2023. The report also points to signs of resistance, including the growing number of states joining South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. This is Amnesty Secretary General Agnes Callamard.
It started with unlawful U.S. and Israeli attack in violation of the U.N. Charter. No self-defense can be invoked here. It morphed into open warfare against civilians, Iran launching indiscriminate, disproportionate retaliatory strikes, Israel escalating its attacks on Lebanon. The conflict is endangering the lives and health of millions of people across the region.
The report comes as Hungary's newly elected prime minister, Péter Magyar, declared his government would be legally obligated to detain Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if he enters Hungarian territory while still subject to an international criminal court arrest warrant. Speaking to reporters, Magyar said, quote, if a country is a member of the ICC and a person who's wanted by the ICC enters our territory, then that person must be taken into custody, unquote. Japan's relaxed decades of restrictions on the sale of weapons and ammunition, clearing the way for arms exports to more than a dozen countries. Today's announcement by the Japanese Prime Minister is a further shift away from Japan's pacifist post-war constitution, created by the U.S. as it occupied Japan 8 decades ago. China said in response it's seriously concerned about Japan's, quote, reckless militarization. Cuba's government's confirmed it recently hosted U.S. officials on the island, marking the first time senior American diplomats have visited the island nation since 2016. Cuban Deputy Foreign Minister Alejandro Garcia del Toro said lifting the U.S. oil blockade is a top priority, calling it, quote, an unjustified punishment of the entire Cuban population. The talks come as President Trump's repeatedly floated the use of military force against Cuba, saying his attention could turn to the island after the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Last week, Trump said, quote, we may stop by Cuba after we finish with this, quote. Meanwhile, the leaders of Mexico, Brazil, and Spain meeting in Barcelona as part of a gathering of progressive heads of state issued a joint statement pledging increased humanitarian aid to Cuba and calling for its sovereignty to be respected. Deaths in ICE custody have reached a record high this fiscal year, with at least 17 immigrants reported dead since January. The most recent case is of 27-year-old Ale Damian Carbonell Betancourt, an immigrant from Cuba, found unresponsive last week while jailed in Miami. He reportedly died of a presumed suicide, but the cause is still under investigation. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Justice Department's demanded officials in Wayne County, Michigan, turn over more than 860,000 ballots, along with envelopes and receipts from the 2024 general election. Trump defeated Kamala Harris to win Michigan's 15 electoral votes, but he lost in Wayne County, which is home to Detroit, by nearly 250,000 votes. The DOJ's threats come weeks after the FBI subpoenaed election records in Arizona's Maricopa County and raided an elections hub in Fulton County, Georgia, seizing thousands of ballots. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel called the request absurd and baseless. She wrote, quote, once again, President Trump's weaponizing the Justice Department in an attempt to sabotage our democratic process and turn it into his own personal agency to interfere in state elections. Meanwhile, FBI Director Kash Patel told Fox News arrests over the 2020 election are coming as soon as this week. In related news, Kash Patel has filed a $250 million defamation lawsuit against The Atlantic magazine and journalist Sarah Fitzpatrick after she reported Patel has alarmed FBI colleagues with episodes of excessive drinking, erratic behavior, and unexplained absences. The report cited more than 24 people, including current and former FBI officials, members of Congress, lobbyists, former advisors, and others. Several officials said morning meetings at the FBI were rescheduled until the afternoon because Patel was incapacitated following nights of heavy drinking. Kash Patel's security detail reportedly struggled to wake him on multiple occasions last year, and in at least one instance requested breaching equipment normally used by SWAT teams to enter buildings. Meanwhile, U.S. Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Remer resigned on Monday amidst a series of reports that she abused her position. She's accused of using public funds for personal travel, bringing subordinates to a strip club, drinking on the job in government offices, and having a romantic affair with her bodyguard. This comes after Chavez de Remer's husband, Sean de Remer, was barred from the Labor Department's headquarters after at least two female staff members reported he sexually assaulted them. Lori Chavez de Remer is the third member of Trump's cabinet to be forced out in the last 7 weeks, all of them women, following the departure of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem and Attorney General Pam Bondi. Wired magazines revealed new details about how facial recognition technology has been used to closely monitor sports fans at the iconic Madison Square Garden in New York. Over a two-year period, security staff for New York Knicks owner James Dolan used the surveillance system to track the movements of a trans woman, in part to prevent her image from being seen on TV. An 18-page dossier obtained by Wired shows the system tracked all of her movements, including when she entered and exited the bathroom. Dolan also used the facial recognition system to ban hundreds of people from the venue, including a group of lawyers involved in disputes with him. Photos of the lawyers were fed into the facial recognition software to prevent them from entering Madison Square Garden. Hundreds of delegates are arriving at the United Nations this week for the world's largest gathering of indigenous peoples, the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. This year's forum centers on the survival of indigenous peoples in the context of armed conflict. Advocates also warn that the artificial intelligence boom is driving a new era of digital extractivism, with tech companies scraping indigenous medicinal knowledge, traditional stories, and genetic data without consent, while massive data centers threaten tribal lands and water resources. The Trump administration's also made it increasingly difficult for delegates from the Global South to obtain U.S. visas to attend the UN forum. And the Goldman Environmental Prize, widely known as the Green Nobel, has announced its 2026 recipients. For the first time since the prize was established in 1989, all six winners were women. They are Iroro Tanchi of Nigeria, Boring Kim of South Korea, Sarah Finch of the United Kingdom, Theonila Roca Matbab of Papua New Guinea, and Yuvelis Morales Blanco of Colombia, and Alana Akak Hurley of the United States. Hurley is the executive director for the United Tribes of Bristol Bay. She led a successful campaign against the Pebble Mine, a proposed gold and copper mine that would have required construction of a massive power plant, natural gas pipeline, and huge toxic tailing ponds.
This award honors all of us, those who stood against all odds, those who never wavered in speaking up against greed and destruction. It honors those who have shown up year after year, writing letters, testifying at hearings, protesting, and raising their kids to value people over profit.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in San Francisco with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As the Trump administration continues to rapidly expand its immigration jail system across the country, we look now at the rising death toll of people in ICE custody, which has reached a record high in over two decades. At least 17 immigrants are reported to have died in ICE custody since January. That's on average about an immigrant death a week. The most recent death is of 27-year-old Aled Damian Carbonell Betancourt, an immigrant from Cuba who was jailed in Miami. He reportedly died of a presumed suicide, but the cause is still under investigation. At least 48 immigrants have died in custody since President Trump returned to office. The cause of death has varied, but includes at least one homicide. In January, El Paso County's medical examiner found that 55-year-old Geraldo Lunas Campos died from asphyxia due to neck and chest compression. Lunas Campos was pronounced dead January 3rd at Camp East Montana, a sprawling immigration detention tent camp at the Forkless military base in El Paso. ICE claimed the Cuban father had died after experiencing medical distress. But several immigrants that he was jailed with later testified they heard Lunas Campos pleading for medication shortly before guards tackled him to the ground. One of the witnesses said in a sworn court declaration he heard a guard tell Lunas Campos, "Shut up or we're going to make you faint." He added, quote, "The last thing I heard was Geraldo speak in a voice that sounded like he couldn't breathe. He said, 'Let go of me. You're asphyxiating me,'" unquote. The Associated Press also reported a witness saw Lunas Campos handcuffed as at least five guards held him down while one put an arm around his neck and squeezed until he was unconscious. Meanwhile, a San Francisco Chronicle investigation found over a dozen deaths under the Trump administration could have been prevented with proper medical care. The Chronicle examined several cases, including Maxime Cherniak. He had a seizure, but they waited to call 911. Luis Beltran Yanez Cruz. He complained of chest pain, but wasn't seen by a doctor for weeks. Santos Benegas Reyes. He was in withdrawal, but not sent to the ER. Lorenzo Antonio Batres Vargas. He couldn't breathe, but they told him to wait. And Ismael Ayala Uribe. He was in severe pain, but they sent him back to his cell. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Sitara Gandahari, Advocacy Director at Detention Watch Network. Can you explain this surge in deaths, Sitara? I'm talking about deaths of immigrants in ICE custody. Explain what you have found.
Good morning, Amy, and thanks for having me. You know, as you said in your intro, we've already seen 17 people die in ICE custody this year, which is an average of about one death per week. And I can tell you I've been tracking these numbers for several years now, including during the COVID-19 pandemic, which was another point where we hit a record number of deaths. And I have never seen anything like this, where I'm seeing ICE reporting out at least one death per week. It's really shocking. And of course, this comes on the heels of a record number of deaths in ICE custody last year, which also, you know, doesn't include the number of deaths that have occurred as ICE has been chaotically and violently targeting immigrant communities, you know, during their enforcement actions. At this point, if we continue to see the same pace of deaths with one death per week, we're set to far exceed last year's record by the end of this year.
And Sitara, how do you explain, given all the amount, all the extra additional skyrocketing amounts of money that the Trump administration has given to ICE, that they seem unable to provide the kind of care necessary for the people they detain?
Sure. Well, you know, ICE has been acting with impunity now for decades, and we have seen really that the system is inherently violent. It's inherently abusive. We've seen these kinds of conditions now that have been documented for decades. And as the Trump administration came into office last year and embarked on its violent and cruel mass deportation campaign, we know that immigration detention has been a key pillar of that campaign. You know, they issued several executive orders in the first days, all of which emphasized the need for expanding ICE detention. They, you know, really kicked off this entire campaign with their announcement about expanding migrant detention at Guantanamo Bay. And they entered into an agreement with the government of El Salvador to offshore detention. And so these two announcements in many ways really serve to normalize the sort of everyday expansion of the system, where we have seen ICE expand its usual contracts with local jails and sheriffs and local prisons. We've seen them expand into military bases, as you mentioned, at Fort Bliss and Texas and others. We have seen a massive expansion into the federal prison system, the reopening of shuttered Bureau of Prisons facilities, agreements, really unprecedented agreements with state governments to open facilities, including the cruelly dubbed Alligator Alcatraz in Florida in the Everglades, as well as the reopening of a shuttered state prison in Indiana. So they have really gone all out. And of course, last summer, their efforts were boosted by a massive, unprecedented infusion of funds from Congress that has allowed them to really ramp up this expansion of the ICE detention system. So as Congress is pouring more and more money into ICE and CBP, this money is being used to really expand the system. And of course, the conditions remain as dire as ever and are being exacerbated because we know that ICE doesn't really care about the well-being of the people in its custody.
And who is responsible for providing medical care and mental health care in ICE facilities? Could you talk about the third-party contractors?
Sure, yes. ICE contracts with third parties to provide medical care. The reality is the system is set up for, with a profit incentive. And of course, ICE isn't really interested in caring for the people in its custody. They're interested in getting as many people into detention and deporting as many people as possible. So routine care goes ungiven. People are ignored to the point of emergency. And so we see, all deaths in ICE custody really are preventable because no one should be in the system to begin with. It's inherently violent, but we're seeing more and more that people are, reaching the point of emergency for issues that could easily be dealt with if proper medical care was given.
Can you talk about the growing opposition around the country to the ICE detention facilities, and what has happened since Kristi Noem left purchasing warehouses across the country to imprison thousands of immigrants? What's happened to those facilities, Satara?
With the warehouses, this is the most recent venture that ICE has gone into in order to expand its system. Of course, in December, they announced plans to purchase dozens of former industrial warehouses across the country and convert them into ICE detention facilities. And of course, we have seen a massive opposition to these warehouses. It's been really inspiring to see people across the country standing up in solidarity with their immigrant neighbors and saying, we don't want these types of facilities in our communities, in our country. It's wrong. And, this is, again, part of a much broader effort that has been going on for many years now at Detention Watch Network. We coordinate the Communities Not Cages campaign, where folks across the country have been fighting against ICE detention centers in their communities for many years. But what we've seen with the announcement of these warehouses is really a grassroots sort of swelling opposition to the growth of this system into facilities that are warehouses. They're meant for industrial labor, for warehousing goods, not for detaining people. And they've been successful, and it's been such an inspiration to see.
Well, last week, Todd Lyons, the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, resigned. Now, he'd never been confirmed by the Senate in his appointment. Your reaction to his resignation and his tenure?
Sure. I mean, what we've seen over the last several weeks is sort of a superficial shakeup of the leadership at ICE and DHS. And I think it's really important to note that, Todd Lyons might be out, but the agenda and the goals of this administration remain the same. And I think what it does speak to, however, is this growing opposition to this violent and chaotic and cruel mass detention and deportation agenda. People across the country are saying, no, this is not the kind of country that we want to live in. And so I think that's why we're seeing this sort of shaky place where the leadership is. And, I think we are prepared to continue that opposition this weekend together with folks across the country. We're engaging in coordinated actions in more than 160 locations across the country to stand up and fight back against this warehouse expansion. And I think, hearing that, seeing that opposition over the last several months has forced ICE to sort of put a pause on that. But I think it's important to remember, first of all, ICE lies. I'm sure that there's negotiations happening behind the scenes. Several warehouses have already been purchased and are set to open. So we're gonna do everything we can to stop that infrastructure from being established. And it's important to remember that this is really part of a broader scheme to expand the ICE detention system. So we really need to keep paying attention to this, because ICE is determined to expand its capacity to detain people to more than 100,000 people at any given time, which is really a shocking number and, you know, a parallel to the number of Japanese Americans that were incarcerated during World War II. So I don't think we can overemphasize how dire and how unprecedented this this agenda is by the current administration.
Before we go, Satari, if you could describe the ongoing detention of families and children at the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Texas.